While most countries across the globe got a handle on the coronavirus pandemic, the United States is still struggling.
The way the U.S. has mishandled and politicized this crisis has deeply undermined the trust that many other countries have for the U.S.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 4th, how the Trump administration's pandemic response could alter our standing on the world stage. And students may be at the forefront of the back-to-school discussion, but the school librarians, custodians, and bus drivers are also concerned, and you're talking to us about it.
I'm a custodian with underlying conditions. I don't think the schools are taking enough precautions to protect us.
I'm nervous about going back, but I feel comfortable that we will be okay.
And finally, what's behind President Trump's battle with TikTok? All that and more, let's get started. The numbers are grim. Nearly 160,000 people have died so far from COVID-19 in the United States. Early in the pandemic, those deaths and the virus itself were largely concentrated in cities like New York and Seattle. But the number of Americans infected with the virus are on the rise in parts of the South and Midwest, as well as in rural America. And even early hotspots like New Jersey and Massachusetts have recently started seeing slight increases in the number of cases there. And as a result of the spread, more Americans could die. Last night, in an interview with Axios reporter Jonathan Swan, President Trump pushed back on the perception that the country is failing in its response to the virus.
If hospital rates were going down and deaths were going down, I'd say terrific. You deserve to be praised for testing, but they're all going up.
You know, they very rarely talk.
60,000 Americans are in hospital.
If you watch the news or read the papers, they usually talk about new cases.
I'm talking about death.
Well, you look at death.
It's going up.
Death is way down from where it was.
It's 1,000 a day. It was 2,500. It went down to 500. Now it's going up again.
Excuse me. Where it was is much higher than where it is right now.
Joining me now is Ranu Dhillon, a global health physician at Harvard Medical School. Ranu, great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Great to be with you.
And Julie Bosman, national correspondent covering the Midwest for the New York Times. Julie, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, let's start with you. I want to focus in on geography here for just a second. The virus, as we mentioned at the top, was largely concentrated on the coast and urban centers. It's now almost everywhere, including rural communities. Why have we seen COVID-19 spread across the country like this, Julie?
Well, in large part, we've seen it spread so widely because the country is largely reopened. In the early stages of the pandemic, we saw huge numbers in the Pacific Northwest and in New York and in the Northeast. And now we've really seen it spread from huge numbers in the Sun Belt and in the West and now in the Midwest. And this is largely just because restaurants are open in many states, bars are open, and people have started returning to living their lives as they did before the pandemic. And I think a lot of people have talked about quarantine fatigue, and they just want to go back to being social. People are having parties in their backyards. People are hosting weddings. And inevitably, the case numbers are going to start rising again, and that's what's happened.
Ranu, as a medical professional on the front lines of this, does the spread of COVID-19 look different in rural versus urban areas right now? We are understanding from Dr. Birx that she is recommending that people attempt to even wear face masks at home in certain circumstances.
Yeah, and I think the distribution of cases is really varied by geography. So in certain places, for example, in California, the Central Valley, which is very rural, you're seeing a lot of transmission. And in other places, you're still seeing a lot of transmission in urban centers. So each place varies, but the general picture is that we have huge rates of transmission across the board in much of the country. And this notion of using masks at home definitely makes sense when people are either a known contact, think they may have been exposed, and certainly if they've been diagnosed. What I see a lot in the patients that I take care of who have COVID is that many of them may have gotten infected either from doing essential work or they live in multi-generational households where someone else in the household has gotten infected doing essential work and has brought the virus back home and then is transmitting to other people in the home. So we definitely need to bolster our response around all of these factors.
Ranu, when you listen to the president's comments at the top there in that interview with Axios saying, really disputing the whether deaths have gone down or deaths have gone up, what are your initial thoughts as a medical professional here?
I think it's an inappropriate characterization of what we're dealing with. What we have is a raging epidemic. We have a crisis. We have 50 to 70,000, depending on the day you look at, detected cases. And we estimate that maybe we're missing 5 times, 10 times as many other cases that we're not testing and diagnosing. So we have tons of circulating virus in the community, and that's not going to change unless we respond more aggressively.
I want to talk a little bit about what that response looks like, Ranu, in just a second. But Julie, we've been talking a lot since the virus and the pandemic started about which communities have been most affected by coronavirus and COVID-19. Are we still seeing that Black, Latino, and Native communities are bearing the brunt of this, or has that started to shift in your reporting?
I think that's still very much happening. I know that since the very beginning of the pandemic in the United States, Latinos have been hospitalized at a rate 4 times that of white Americans. And there are a lot of reasons why that's happening. Latinos, for instance, are, of course, disproportionately represented in essential workforce jobs. So they've been overexposed to the virus, and they have lower rates of health insurance in many cases. And that's still happening. And in fact, probably the worst region in the country right now for coronavirus is in the border counties in Texas, where you're seeing families, you know, multi-generational households, and the numbers are just enormous there, and it's just completely out of control.
You know, we're going to talk to, I'm going to ask Ranu just a second in terms of what the aggressive approach should look like, but we did know, Julie, that Vanity Fair published a pretty explosive piece on alleged secret testing by the Trump administration early on in the pandemic, and whether or not, you know, there were lots of questions raised about whether or not the federal government was approaching this apolitically, or whether or not they had a very political lens on where to distribute resources. Tell us a little bit about what the findings were in that piece.
So I believe that piece focused on the task force, the coronavirus task force, based in the White House. And one of the more startling assertions in that piece was that Jared Kushner, of course, the president's son-in-law, had realized early on that the pandemic was hitting blue states hardest, and that he believed that a national plan was unnecessary and wouldn't help the White House politically. I think what we have seen, certainly from the very beginnings in the federal response, is an effort to shift responsibility to the states. And that's why we've seen so many governors who have really been in charge of their response, who've been forced to procure testing supplies on their own. And that is something that's really contributed to the fact that we've had such a patchwork of responses, that one state can say we have a mask mandate and another state that's next door, with people constantly going over the border, does not, which has obviously hampered our national response to fighting this pandemic.
Ranu, at the national level, I recall a couple of weeks ago, I bought a copy of the New York Times in print because it printed, we had reached a milestone of 100,000 Americans dead from the coronavirus and COVID-19. As we mentioned at the top, we are now close to 160,000 people in this country who have died. Are you optimistic, Ranu, that those numbers will begin to slow down? Or, as we mentioned at the top, are we continuing to be on a path where many more Americans will die?
Well, I think right now, if we continue on the path that we're on, we are going to see more and more deaths. In fact, I think the CDC yesterday was projecting over 10,000 deaths potentially each week this month. Now, the good news is that whether that happens or not, or what happens, is really on us. There are a lot of steps we can take to change that trajectory, and even change that trajectory relatively quickly. So it's really a matter of how we try to proceed going forward. And I think if we're willing to make the changes we need to be able to bring that curve down.
You mentioned changes and having an aggressive approach. What does that look like right now, Ranu? I mean, we've been talking, you know, about wearing face masks. We've been talking about social distancing. We've been talking about hand washing. And to Julie's point earlier, if you're in one state that has a mask mandate and you cross over into another that doesn't, you know, we haven't shut down airports, for example. I mean, what does an aggressive approach look like right now, Ranu?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So what we can do is close down places that we know where transmission is more likely to happen. So that's indoors and in crowded settings, in gatherings where a lot of people are close together, and moving more activities outdoors where we know the transmission risk is much lower. Second step we can take is improving testing. So we've talked a lot about testing over the last couple of months, but what we really need to start thinking about shifting towards are rapid paper strip tests that by spitting on a piece of paper, you can get results within a matter of minutes. Now, these tests don't work as well as the tests that we use in hospitals, but they can be rapidly mass produced and people can actually administer them themselves. And what you could start doing is having people as frequently as possible, ideally on a daily basis, testing themselves, especially in areas that are hotspots. So the moment anyone is infectious and capable of passing the virus to somebody else, they realize that and then can take the appropriate steps to isolate themselves. Another measure is improving the distribution of masks and the quality of masks, especially the ones that we're giving to essential workers. So the cloth masks that we're wearing in public can do a lot to block people from emitting out the virus, and they do also help blocking some of the virus from coming in. But we do know that some of the particles are small enough to get through those masks, especially in settings where you have people working in close confines and there's a higher risk of transmission, we should be using higher quality masks that can more definitively block the virus coming in and going out. And an additional step is to really start understanding locality by locality, what is the narrative of transmission? And what I mean by that is understanding where and how people are getting infected. In some settings, it may be that people are going to parties and family gatherings. In other places, it could be mostly from people doing essential jobs and then spreading within their households. Once we start understanding more about how transmission is specifically happening in a location-specific way, we can then start gearing our efforts towards blocking off those pathways of spread.
Julie, yesterday, the president, given everything that Ranu just said, particularly closing down certain establishments, the president in a press conference yesterday said he clearly would not shut down the United States. We are not going back to a total national shutdown. When you hear that and you're reporting, what is that? What do you think about that? I mean, that feels like, based on what Ranu said, that's one of the best ways to do it. Does the administration have another plan other than shutting it all down?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that, look, we're in a situation now where we have casinos and bars and restaurants open, and yet we are not sure if we'll be able to open schools in a few weeks. So we've had a problem of priorities. I don't know that there is a coherent national plan coming from the White House for what is next. I think the president has his eye on his reelection fight. I do think this is probably going to come back down to the governors and their ability within their own states to retighten restrictions once again. And we've heard that all over the country. We've seen California close its bars and restaurants again. We've seen a lot of states start closing down again. And I think that if they have the support of their legislature, and if they have one-party control, which is true in almost every state in this country, then they'll do what they feel is necessary to protect their residents.
Julie Bosman is national correspondent for the New York Times, and Ranu Dhillon is global health physician at Harvard Medical School. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Great to be with you.
My friends, make no mistake. The greatest threat we face now is not the virus itself. Rather, it's the lack of leadership and solidarity at the global and national levels.
That was World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus delivering a warning to international leaders on July 9th. As we just heard, the United States is struggling to contain COVID-19. At the end of June, the U.S. had 25% of the world's coronavirus cases, despite accounting for just 4% of the global population. And that's according to data released by Johns Hopkins University. Recently, a number of countries that were thought to have their outbreaks under control have seen upticks in cases, though the rates of cases in those countries pale in comparison to the United States.
Japan, for example, they have a much larger caseload than they did a couple months ago. And as a consequence, they're going back towards lockdown.
That's Ian Bremmer, president of the geopolitical risk firm Eurasia Group.
In Australia, you have one state right now that is going to put a high state of emergency on. And it shows that, you know, even a little bit of people getting back to normal can lead to an awful lot of transmission of this coronavirus.
Ian told me that something setting our country apart from other nations are the political divisions that have emerged here around public safety measures like mask wearing and social distancing.
The fact that this has been politicized in the United States, that up until very recently, the president himself was unwilling to proactively support and demonstrate mask wearing, even as his Surgeon General was doing everything he could to promote science, is truly unfortunate. It's obviously not displaying leadership internationally, and it fails the American citizens. The fact that you still have, I mean, I just saw Peter Navarro, White House senior advisor, knows nothing about medicine, but nonetheless saying that hydroxychloroquine is something he believes that we should continue to support, like the Brazilian president has, for example. Huge mistake. The medical community, to a person, disagrees with that take. But the United States was actually stockpiling it because the president said he thought it was good and decided to take it himself. As ostensibly a preventative measure. So, I mean, look, when we look at the countries that have done a good job, it's not wealthy or poor countries. It's not big or small countries. It's not democratic or authoritarian countries. It's actually a bunch of governments that decided early that they were going to let the people with expertise actually lead the response, and they didn't politicize it. Vietnam would be an authoritarian state that did that well. South Korea, certainly Germany, large, democratic, Norway, New Zealand, Greece, Argentina, quite poor, but also have been effective. I mean, there are actually, I could point to about 20 countries, Uruguay, about 20 countries around the world that have actually done an extremely good job. And they've had all of the things I just mentioned in common. They didn't politicize, they didn't cheerlead, and they got on it early, letting the people with expertise, letting the scientists, letting the doctors actually lead the response, because it's a pandemic. And it's a pandemic that we have no experience with before. So clearly, you're going to want people that have the best understanding of a massive healthcare crisis and how to respond to it and how to learn quickly and change your policy on the basis of that. You want those to be the people making decisions. And in the United States, certainly at the state level and the city level, it was very mixed, some good, some bad, some changing over time, right? But at the federal level, massive mistakes on that front being made by the administration.
Last month, President Trump notified the World Health Organization that the United States would be withdrawing from the group and pulling funding from the group, and this is supposed to go into effect this coming year. How would you say that decision has been received by international community leaders?
Probably, I mean, almost uniquely badly. I mean, it's very hard to unify. It's a very divided world. It's very hard to unify every leader in the world against the decision that you make. I think President Trump managed that by announcing that he was leaving the WHO in the middle of a pandemic. Maybe the only other decision he made along those lines would have been the decision to leave the Paris Climate Accord, where every other government in the world opposed what the United States was doing. It's really hard to do that. But Trump has a knack for finding policies that are maximally antagonistic of other countries. And, you know, the America first idea that he has means that other countries can kind of go scratch. And he does bring that to bear, even though, as you mentioned, the decision to leave the World Health Organization is something that the U.S. can't actually effectuate until a year after the announcement. So as of right now, literally today, The engagement that the U.S. continues to have with the WHO, sharing of data, working with them at the rest, continues unabated. It hasn't actually changed. Same is true of the Paris Climate Accord, by the way. In both cases, the U.S. only can leave after the elections in November. So what people do at the ballot box in the coming months will actually matter to both of these outcomes.
Ian, in addition to the Trump administration's antagonism and relationship or lack thereof with the WHO, we're also seeing on an international level a number of countries, including the entire European Union, China, Japan, and New Zealand, have banned American travelers. What does that say? I mean, I feel like there's evidence mounting here, Ian, that the United States is not seen as a global partner in the coronavirus response. And dare I say, we have become somewhat of a I don't want to say laughing stock, but have we?
I mean, I wouldn't go that far, right? I mean, it is certainly true that, remember, we stopped the Chinese from coming into the U.S. Other countries did, too, very early. Australia, for example, though Japan and South Korea did not. We were the ones that told the Europeans they were not allowed to come here when that was the epicenter. And we didn't even tell the Europeans. They found out on cable news and they condemned us the next day. But we cut them off. Their passports were less useful at this point. Now you've got far more case transmission and deaths per capita in the United States on a weekly basis than you do in Europe, than certainly you do in China and Japan. So these countries are, you know, it's a reciprocal decision, right? And no one should blame them for doing that. I do think that the way the U.S. has mishandled and politicized this crisis has deeply undermined the trust that many other countries have for the U.S. and has for our government. But I would also point out that at the same time, the tech companies that are absolutely critical for getting us through and out of this pandemic, the geo-tracing that we're going to need, the virtual commerce that we need, those companies are overwhelmingly in the West American. And so the U.S. is also, the private sector is leading the way out of this economic crisis, even as the U.S. government is doing such a poor job in responding to the pandemic itself. The dollar, the U.S. dollar, is still the reserve currency of the world. We still export an enormous amount of food and energy to a lot of the countries that don't want our people right now. And that's going to continue.
Ian, there's an Associated Press poll from May that found that 50%, 50, or half of U.S. adults that were surveyed said they were unsure about getting vaccinated when one is available. So off of your point that the U.S. is providing a lot of the e-commerce, the dollar is still strong on a lot of the services to get through this, we're also in the vaccine race. And at the same time, as our infection rates are as high as they are, and we stand to play a role in creating a vaccine, half of Americans surveyed by this, by the Associated Press, say that they don't want to get a vaccine.
It's true that there are anti-vaxxers in the U.S. and that social media has led to a lot, even further polarization of extreme views and fake news. And that's very damaging. For the ability to lead with science, which includes being able to use and take a vaccine. By the way, the anti-vaxxer movement is actually stronger per capita in France than is in the United States. This is not just an American problem. But let's also keep in mind that the early vaccines that are, you know, now moving into phase three trials in human beings like Moderna and others, there are clearly a lot of side effects, most of which aren't serious, but some of which could be serious for older people, particularly with pre-existing conditions. It looks like they don't exist. It's not just one shot, but you probably need a booster shot. And for some older people, you might need more than one. And we also see that this isn't a silver bullet. It's likely to work like a regular flu shot, which means it's going to reduce hospitalizations. It'll reduce mortality, but it won't stop you from getting the disease. At the same time, there's news out right now that the Russians are planning a Sputnik moment with their vaccine before it's actually gone through phase three trials, which clearly would be not safe in any way for the Russian public. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if a significant piece of the numbers that you're seeing saying they're not going to take a vaccine is because at this point, we don't yet know when a vaccine is quote unquote ready, is the FDA going to, you know, completely approve taking that vaccine? Do we trust that people that we're hearing from in the media, including some articles I've seen recently, one big one in Forbes magazine with someone who does seem to have a solid medical background, saying that the initial vaccines, even if they haven't been tested properly, we should allow people to take them if they volunteer. No, you shouldn't. But, you know, so I think in the environment where there's so much uncertainty and we don't know what the vaccines is yet, I would take those numbers with a grain of salt. They're probably a lot greater than the anti-vax movement would have you believe.
And finally, given everything that we just laid out, do you think the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic could shape how the international community views the United States long term, at least from a policy standpoint, if not just the way they think of our country?
They're certainly less happy with the United States and less happy with Trump. But I think it's interesting that as the United States, as Trump goes after China and Huawei and 5G and TikTok, turns out that most of our allies around the world are absolutely with us. And in part, that's because they have similar interests. And in part, it's because the United States is much more powerful than those countries and they don't want to get hurt. When the U.S. left the Iranian nuclear deal, all the other countries that were involved opposed it, but they still went along with their sanctions. Why? Because the U.S. is a lot more important than Iran. When we had Mexico and Canada and we were moving, said we're getting rid of NAFTA unless you do this new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, they got on board. Even we told the Mexicans you had to increase your border security on your southern border or we're going to tariff you. They did it. And it's funny, Trump said that we're going to build a wall. Mexico's going to pay for it. It turned out he was right. It just wasn't the American wall. It was the wall on the south of the Mexico border with Central America. Look, I'm not trying to say this because I think Trump is brilliant or doing a fantastic job. I just think it's important to recognize that when you're the most powerful country in the world, and that isn't going away, and when you're so much more powerful than your allies, you still have an awful lot of influence over what they're going to do. And so, no, I don't think suddenly the United States isn't listened to by anyone just because we do things that they don't want. I do think that there are more effective ways of governing and getting the outcomes we'd like for the long term than what we've been doing in many cases in the last few years.
Ian Bremmer is the president of Eurasia Group. Ian, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
We're continuing to look at back-to-school plans for districts across the country. And we're hearing not just from teachers, but from all sorts of professionals in school settings on how they feel about returning to work, including food service workers, bus drivers, custodians, paraeducators, school secretaries, nurses, and librarians.
My name's Lisa Adams, and I am a media specialist / librarian in an elementary school for Alpine School District.
That's in northern Utah. And Lisa told us what she's been hearing from her school district.
I feel like they make an effort in that they tell us that they're listening and that they're trying. They've provided us with face shields and masks, and they're trying to make sure that we have the sanitizer and everything that we would need. I just logistically don't know how feasible or possible it is to really maintain the guidelines that we have been asked to do. And in Utah, we have big class sizes. Just the logistics of trying to do your job, whether it's like me being basically a specialty rotation for the students or in the classroom, or if you're on a bus, the logistics are just unrealistic about trying to be as safe as what you would think would be possible. But it's impossible to be in education and really follow those to a T. For me, being a librarian, trying to do a story time where they're all spread completely, they have to stay at their desks. Usually when you're reading a story, you have that just kind of magic circle of where they're cloaks and you feel that connection to them and you can really discuss things. It's just going to feel a little bit more rigid. Trying to do that and have them hear me in a mask or in a face shield will be interesting. I just feel like it's me being exposed to 700 kids or 650 kids walking in and out of a class every week. People who have to rotate in and out, you're talking about aides in the classroom or any people like me that would really be exposed to the whole population of the student body. Those things make me worried, not for me necessarily, but for anyone else that I could transmit it to. And, you know, we don't need to start losing educators before people take this a little more seriously. I just feel maybe that it's a little hasty for me personally, but we'll do it. It's just scary.
Do you work in a school setting? Tell us what you're feeling about the school's plans in your area. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And here's what some other school workers had to say.
Hi, I'm Renard from Long Beach, California. I'm a custodian with underlying conditions. I don't think the schools are taking enough precautions to protect us, and we're not being tested, and social distancing is often difficult. So I don't know what the result of all this will be, but I just pray that I don't get COVID.
My name is Thomas, and I am a former crosswalking guard for Redondo Beach School District in California. I am so happy that I am not working at this time. If I had to go to work at a school right now, I would be very nervous and I would be very anxious because children love to touch. They want to touch you and hug you and give you a high five.
My name is Kathy. I'm calling from Medford, New Jersey. I have been in class support paraprofessional for many years. My job is a one-to-one aide for students who have learning or behavior issues. There is absolutely no way, if schools are open, I could do my job effectively with any kind of 6-foot social distancing. So I have decided not to go back to the company I work for. My position is outsourced.
This is Tony. I'm calling from Reno, Nevada. I wanted to let you know I'm a teaching assistant. We'll be going back to school starting Monday, August 17th. I'm kind of glad that we're going back. The kids need to get back. I'm nervous about going back, but with all the safety equipment that the school district will be providing, I feel comfortable that we will be okay.
Thanks for sharing. And again, you can weigh in anytime. Call and leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Since its debut in 2017, the Chinese app TikTok has become one of the fastest growing social media tools with more than 800 million active users. The app lets users make short videos that are often shared across the internet. But TikTok isn't all fun and games. For months now, a lot of the attention about the app has been focused on the national security concerns and the collection of user data. And as a result, the platform has been banned in India, by multiple branches of the U.S. military, and by Wells Fargo employees. Most recently, however, President Trump took aim at TikTok himself by threatening to ban the app.
We're looking at TikTok. We may be banning TikTok. We may be doing some other things. There are a couple of options. But a lot of things are happening, so we'll see what happens. But we are looking at a lot of alternatives with respect to TikTok.
Those remarks were before reports surfaced that Microsoft was pursuing a deal to buy TikTok. In a press conference at the White House yesterday, President Trump claimed Microsoft or any other company would have to wait until September 15th to acquire the app and would be expected to give a percentage of the profit from the sale to the U.S. Treasury. Joining me now is Graham Webster, editor of DigiChina Project at Stanford University's Cyber Policy Center and a fellow at New America. Graham, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Callan Rosenblatt is a youth and internet culture reporter for NBCNews.com. Callan, thanks for being with us as well.
Glad to be here.
Callan, who is the average TikTok user?
The average TikTok user really is a dynamic question, because there is a huge range of different people who are using the app. But I'd say the most common person you're going to find is someone who is either at the tail end of high school or early years of college, who is definitely solidly in Generation Z, Gen Z, and he was using the app mostly for fun, to do dance challenges, trends, and engage with communities that sort of speak to their world.
Graham, all of that sounds pretty basic. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's anything to be concerned about so far. What type of data does TikTok collect from its users, Graham?
Well, TikTok is like a lot of other social media companies these days. It's using an AI-driven or machine learning-driven algorithm to figure out which content to serve to individual users. So to get this accomplished, they pay attention to, obviously, whatever you post, but also, you know, what posts on your feed you look at, how long you look at them, where your device location is. They also try to track individual users, like many apps do, by looking at things like screen size and operating system. And of course, they have a fair amount of information about your social graph, your connections to friends and other people that you follow.
And so what were some of the concerns around the data collection that way, Graham, given that it feels like there's a lot of, as you mentioned, other social media platforms and advertisers and the like that are tracking everything that we do already? Why is TikTok being highlighted here and banned in some of the institutions that we mentioned at the top?
Well, the basic reason is that TikTok is owned by a Chinese company named ByteDance, and they're a fairly new social media company. They had a breakout a few years ago in China with an app called Junior Toutiao that is a an algorithmic news feed. And this is China's first big breakout internationally in terms of social media apps and really getting take up in many different countries around the world, not just the United States. So there's a concern that data collected by TikTok could end up in the hands of the Chinese company or the Chinese government. And while TikTok says that it stores all U.S. user data in the U.S. or in Singapore, we don't really have a good way as a society right now to check that type of thing and to make sure that companies commit, when they commit to, you know, storing data in a safe way, making sure that they're actually doing that.
It doesn't sound like we have a lot of that in the United States either, though, Graham. I mean, we have constant security breaches left and right.
Right. Well, the United States doesn't have a central data governance or data security or privacy regulatory system. The most prominent example of one globally is Europe, which has the General Data Protection Regulation called the GDPR. And that governs things like when an app or a service is going to collect your personal information, they have to gain certain types of consent and follow certain types of rules. And there's also kind of limits, the idea that if you collect data for a certain reason that you got consent for, you shouldn't be able to use it for other reasons. And that type of governance is just not that prominent in the U.S., partially because the big U.S. Social media companies are not especially keen to have their practices heavily regulated. They find GDPR in Europe to be burdensome and, get in the way of making money.
Callan, back in June, President Trump organized a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and rumor has it that TikTok users promoted buying tickets for the event and didn't show up so that the event would be empty. What do we know about how that rubbed the administration?
So what we know is it seemed to sort of frustrate the administration. Now, there's no evidence that the TikTok users and K-pop stans who are fans of Korean pop music, that they had any impact on turnout. You know, we are going through a global pandemic. There are a lot of factors going on right now. So it is really hard to know sort of what that impact was. But what we do know is it likely inflated expectations for turnout. The administration was planning to have a second rally after the main rally in Tulsa, which they then had to cancel. And so we think that it really messed with them. It was a real genuine troll on the part of these TikTok users against the president, and it really seemed to rub him the wrong way. And there are lots of TikTok users, young first-time voters, who are telling me that when Trump said he wanted to ban this app, that was a retaliation for what they did, the stunt they pulled, the prank they pulled in Tulsa.
That's what they think is happening.
There is no evidence that that's the president's line of thinking, but that's what these 18 to 22 year olds are telling me that that's their belief.
Callan, we talked about the, you know, whether or not TikTok users actually had any effect on the Trump rally in Tulsa back in June. But more directly here, I'm wondering if you're seeing any more political movement on the app, whether it's pro-Trump or pro-Biden or anti-Trump, anti-Biden. Has it started to move away from dance and song and move towards more political leanings so far?
It can do both things at once, actually. So there are still the dance trends. There are massive accounts that are just, you know, enjoying music on the app. But we see a lot of politics on TikTok now, maybe more than ever. And some young people are telling me they feel that because they're home in quarantine and because politics is ramping up nationally as we get closer to this election, that they're seeing more and more politics in their feed. And what we're seeing is not so much pro-Biden content, but a lot of anti-Trump content. And I want to be clear, there is Republican TikTok, Democrat TikTok, liberal TikTok, conservative TikTok. But what it appears to be is a lot of Generation Z has a anti-Trump sentiment. And that does not mean they have a pro-Biden sentiment. But things that we see are young people saying, hey, on this day, everyone go to President Trump's campaign store and put these products in your cart, but don't check out because allegedly that messes with their inventory. Or everyone on this day, go to President Trump's Twitter account and report his account and let's see if we can get it taken down. So we're still seeing these sort of organized movements sort of troll the president and a lot of discussion of politics. But whether or not that is in favor of Vice President Biden or in favor of President Trump is sort of yet to be seen.
Graham, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, it sounds like TikTok users are, for the most part, having fun on the site, sort of, you know, trying to do the things that Callan is talking about here. But on a more serious note, the Trump administration has been trying to ban the app. They are citing national security concerns and concerns over censorship by the Chinese government. How valid are any of those concerns, really, given what you know about China-U.S. politics?
Well, I think it's you have to separate them out. So the concern about censorship, I think, is legitimate. There was an example a little while ago where it looked like some of the censorship that they would do in China, restricting conversations about things the Communist Party doesn't like discussed, had bled over into the international product. Now, TikTok said that they were addressing that and it wasn't intended. Again, we don't really have a good way in the United States to check up on that and to kind of make sure that speech isn't being censored one way or the other. The national security issue, I think, requires a lot more imagination. Now, you know, as was mentioned, the military has told service members to not use the app. And I think that makes a good amount of sense. You know, if you're concerned about an app having links to a potential adversary, there's all sorts of possibilities of ways that it could be exploited, even just using location data of service members or people who work in sensitive facilities. But if you don't work in sensitive facilities, if you're just sort of going around and doing the fun things and engaging in some of the political discourse that Callan was mentioning, you know, there's not a real big national security issue there. I will say that some people think that collecting the full aggregate totality of U.S. TikTok users could be used later in AI analysis to try to do something. But it's really imaginative at this point, whereas I think the censorship concerns are real and could be checked on, and data privacy concerns are real but should be able to be checked on as well.
What about the fact that we just heard from Ian Bremmer, the president of the Eurasia Group, in the previous segment, talking about how the United States is viewed internationally in terms of our response to the coronavirus? But I did ask Ian also about his thoughts on what this TikTok dust up between President Trump and China, so what seemed to be rooted in. And he said, you know, this is also part of Trump's sort of relationship with how he views China and Chinese technology. He's gone after Huawei. He's gone, you know, sort of talked a lot about 5G technology. So do you see that? I mean, do you see that as a pattern in how the president views technology specifically that's coming out of China?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration's been pursuing a campaign of, escalating what could be a new type of Cold War approach to China. And a lot of it is wrapped up in technology. And I think the focus on TikTok really makes the most sense if you consider it a distraction from two things. First is a distraction from actual problems with China. You know, the Trump administration got this phase one trade deal, which didn't really get to the deep issues of subsidy and market access and intellectual property protection. And on the other hand, it's distracting from the fact that a lot of these security concerns should apply across many apps. Why just TikTok? You know,
and you're talking about including American-made apps like Facebook, right, and Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, the concerns are different when the parent company is in China, but there are really unaccountable data collection methods going on across ad networks, and data brokers are building profiles of Americans and people in other countries that can be purchased just with money. And you know, it's not only ad companies that buy this data. Governments can get it, too.
Callan, as we sort of touched on this earlier, but of course, I say this all the time, we're heading into one of the most consequential presidential elections in my lifetime, at least. Social media is constantly changing. Is TikTok going to be a thing in 2020 in November, or is it going to be eclipsed with something else, or will it change the election? Callan, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't see TikTok going away anytime soon, as long as the president allows it to operate in the United States. I think we're going to see more organizing on the app among young people. And, you know, I think we're going to see TikTok, as long as Microsoft buys it or another company comes in to allow it to operate in the U.S., I think it's going to stick around for a long time.
I mean, the president, Callan, has also asked that Microsoft give money to the Treasury if it makes this sale. Is anybody else interested in buying TikTok, or is it just Microsoft right now?
I don't think anyone else has come out, as far as I'm aware, and said that they are interested in purchasing TikTok. I think Microsoft even just recently confirmed that they were interested in this conversation. But it appears a deal needs to be made by September 15th. So if someone's going to buy it, it has to happen soon.
Well, you heard it here, I guess, first. Callan Rosenblatt is a youth and internet culture reporter for NBCNews.com, and Graham Webster is the editor of the DigiChina Project at the Stanford University Cyber Policy Center, and he's also a fellow at New America. Graham, Callan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you listening during these times. If you have anything you want to share with us, you can always find us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.